When it comes to scents, you should pick ones that smell like, well, you. Target gets it, which is why they offer a range of personal care products with fragrances for everyone. Be true to floral you with Dove Peony and Rose Body Wash. Live your fresh life with Degree Ultra Clear Deodorant. Express your decadent side with Love Beauty and Planet Coconut Shampoo. This spring, choose care that brings you joy beyond labels. Pick up new favorites at a Target near you or online at Target.com.
And we're back. It's another episode of Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
I'm disappointed too. I'm Louis Fertel. Welcome to all of this. I threw my hands up in the air, disappointed, despairing.
I got to tell you, we're going to talk about Elvis this week, everyone. We're going to talk about music and white theft. Probably the BET Awards, because that involves white theft too.
My favorite Jimmy Cagney movie, by the way, White Theft.
My favorite Madonna song is White Theft.
Oh my God, we need to get into the True Blue era. He's referencing White Heat, which was a tribute itself to Jimmy Cagney. But if
I was
you're not,
talking about Vogue.
Oh, that true? That's, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's an,
a joke.
The True Blue non-singles. Yes, yes. The True Blue non-singles, really full of bubblegummy endorphins for all time. I was also just listening to Jody Watley's 80s output, which sounds a lot like True Blue. So this has been on my mind.
I was actually thinking about you the other day when I saw my friend Lucas's uncle, Bruce Bozzi, who you might know at this party. And he was wearing a vintage like Madonna erotica shirt.
I will never forget when I interviewed Lady Gaga for The Advocate in 2008. I was her first interview for The Advocate. I said to her, at the time, she was like a known Madonna fan and would just talk about Madonna in interviews. This is, of course, a far away, long ago era. This is not the same era we live in now. But I said, what's your favorite Madonna era? And she goes, erotica, because they couldn't even play it at 2:30 in the morning, or they had to play it at 2:30 in the morning. And I remember thinking at the time, oh, she actually does know. She's like watched the MTV behind the scenes documentaries and stuff. She's really up to date on Madonna. So that's kept me impressed with Lady Gaga ever since.
You know, they only air Keep It at 2:30 in the mornings on podcast one.
Oh, that's right. Next to 120 minutes. What other shows would be on in the middle of the night on MTV? Undressed.
Yeah. Speaking of another Madonna connection, we're interviewing Jenny Slate today, who has her latest film, Marcel, the Shell with the Shoes On, and Isabella Rossellini is in that film, and Isabella Rossellini is in The Sex Book.
As she should be. The Sex Book would be incomplete without her. I was, by the way, at San Francisco Pride over the weekend, and my friend Jan Hatchewell, who's a Twitter gay, nice guy.
I love Jan.
Yeah, he's a huge Kylie fan, but he's also a huge Madonna fan. And in his living room, he had The Sex Book open, and the picture that it was on his coffee table for everybody to see is Madonna like chewing on a guy's ass. And I just want to say, among the ways she was ahead of her time, putting ass eating out there, as in eating a dude's ass. I mean, God, that took like 23 years after that to get into Vogue.
I think there needs to be some sort of reunion of everyone who's in The Sex Book.
Oh yeah, Big Daddy Kane and Tony Ward, all those models that are in the book.
Yeah, I love whenever Twitter like rediscovers like Big Daddy Kane, like being in the book, but also being like sexy in that period.
Right. Yeah. Helen Mirren's a big fan of The Sex Book. That's when I became a Helen Mirren fan, when she said Madonna knew exactly what she was doing then. By the way, I've taken notes recently. We've been told we talk about Madonna way too much on this podcast, and we are literally launching right into classic Madonna. So fuck you. I like who we are.
People have had it.
Right. I sort of agree.
Well, we're going to talk about Elvis this week. We're going to talk about Baz Luhrmann, our favorite director.
You need to not say that to me while I'm sitting right here. I can't hit you with a rolling pin from here.
You know, I go back and forth on this man, and I used to call him the worst director, because I rediscovered that I hate Moulin Rouge. Years later, turns out you were right, Michael Murray, when you borrowed my DVD of Moulin Rouge in high school, returned it like 12 years later, and then were like, ugh, it was bad.
Yeah, it's only the Nicole performance I enjoy, but for instance, like the Smells Like Teen Spirit version, the Like a Virgin, I just, I know there are gay people who love this movie, but it just felt like, I don't know, like a fancy pop-up book or something with lots of colors in it. And then I'm like, okay, but let's close the book. I don't want to have a seizure.
Right. And then I saw Romeo and Juliet for the first time during the pandemic, and I wish I had not.
Not good. The soundtrack's good.
Yeah. And less said about Australia, the better.
Though there is a scene with, I believe, a kangaroo in it early. No, there's a scene with a car accident early on where Nicole gets to do hard, broad, borderline commedia dell'arte acting. And that I support.
But Elvis, I think I like it. So we're going to get into that.
I'll reserve my opinion until it is time for me to have the opinion, but we'll get into it.
Okay, well, we will be right back with more Keep It. This week on What a Day, Travelle interviews Peppermint of Drag Race and finds out if she'd ever compete on All Stars. The suspense is killing us.
Plus, Joan Jett Black and Taylor Alexander stop by to talk about drag as political action. Listen to new episodes of What a Day weekday mornings wherever you get your podcasts.
Baz Luhrmann's Elvis biopic opened this weekend, beating out Top Gun Maverick to the top of the box office and earning mostly positive reviews, especially for Austin Butler's performance. It's the latest dizzying, music-filled film from Luhrmann, and we have thoughts. I first want to say, film is back.
IndieWire.com. What do you mean?
I will say, though, that apparently this weekend was like one of the first weekends where the four top films made over $20 million at the box office.
Oh, that's
bizarre. The last time it happened since 2018. So,
okay, I am encouraged by that. And also, by the way, I want to say that I'm very surprised that Top Gun lost out to Elvis, because I was just thinking, the cultural memory of Elvis, I feel, has taken a major hit in the past 15 years. For instance, when I was in high school or younger, you would grow up and see, you know, maybe a family member even would have collectible Elvis memorabilia, or, you know, there'd be commercials for Elvis compilations. When we were in high school, there was the Elvis Number Ones collection with the Junkie XL remix of A Little Less Conversation that we still love, right? What a great remix. But I just don't feel like there are many inroads to knowing who Elvis even was anymore. Like, I think you'd be hard pressed to find somebody under the age of 25 who knows about, you couldn't, they had to film him from the waist up on Ed Sullivan, or, you know, even where the phrase Elvis has left the building has come from. So the fact that we're getting this movie now at a time where I feel like the entire memory of the 1950s has to do with either a kind of Pleasantville vision of suburbia or Mad Men
or water hoses
is interesting. Yes. So I'm pleased we get an Elvis movie. I guess we did have Being the Ricardos recently too. Mm-hmm. But for instance, Marilyn Monroe, that's an image people still remember, and Elvis, I feel like, has just withered a bit. But
we need Kim K to start walking around wearing Elvis's suits.
I mean, don't give her ideas. I mean, sounds like she'll just do it.
I will say, actually, speaking of one of those, one of the most iconic moments of someone like doing an Elvis sort of like thing with one of his suits was, I feel like people watching this film are maybe even too young to remember the time when Britney did her first Vegas show and she was wearing the Elvis all white suit.
Oh, right. I totally forgot about that.
Yeah. And that would have been a reference to him back when we were still constantly making references to him. And it excited me, like, looking up Elvis stuff after this. Like, I always love doing that after a biopic, mostly because you get to remember that pop culture is always referencing itself. Like, you may think that, like, we talk about it now in a way that, like, people didn't discuss it before, but they did. And you think of like Colonel Parker, and we'll get into Tom Hanks's portrayal of this man, which is unhinged.
Do you know what it was giving
to put
to
it
me?
Lightly?
We already brought up Goosebumps this episode. I'll bring up another 90s favorite of this podcast. He was giving Dr. Vink from Are You Afraid of the Dark,
with the who just shows up.
Yeah. You know, showing up with an amulet and tempting you with something strange. Like, I didn't realize Colonel Tom Parker was so like Maria Uspenskaya-esque, you know, like a strange gypsy woman here to ensnare Elvis.
But I was looking up like references to Colonel Parker, right? And apparently there's even like an old Flintstones episode where, you remember the Flintstones episode where Fred records an album?
No,
like a single. He records a single, and then like he becomes like a pop star briefly, and like there's like a Colonel Parker-esque character who becomes his manager. So like even in like 1961, like people knew who Elvis's manager was and were making fun of him in
right.
like a an animated cartoon for kids.
Yeah, right. That seems very Animaniacs of the Flintstones. I'm surprised they had the gall and the nerve.
I feel like every old Flintstones episode is actually a pop culture reference to something that was going on at the time.
Well, of course, the entire show is. You know, yeah. Jackie Gleason was considering suing because it's just a ripoff of The Honeymooners in every way. It's just The Honeymooners.
But first, let's talk about Austin Butler, who I thought was fucking amazing. And I would say there's not enough of him in the movie.
Yes, to me, this movie has the problem that, and I'm sorry to do this, I just brought up Madonna, that Evita has, where it feels like it's all music video and fast segues, and you never feel like you're just in a scene with the person the movie is supposed to be about. Like, you never feel like you're getting to the heart of Elvis, you're just watching a montage of Elvis.
I would almost relate it to Lerman's Great Gatsby, you know, where you have this narrator talking about, you know, Leo's character, which makes sense because that's how the book is actually written. But Tom Hanks is narrating this entire fucking movie, and you're getting all this backstory about him. And I'm like, can I just watch a movie about Elvis?
Yeah, because you also don't get really a fully dimensional take on Colonel Tom Parker either. You just understand that he's a scheming, manipulative so-called snowman who ensnares Elvis. That's it. You don't get to the, like, and at the end he's sick. You know, there's nothing more interesting there. There's, you know, the dynamic doesn't really deepen between that character and Elvis either. But to me, this
also,
movie,
the snowman, as he's referred to, every time they say snow job in the movie, I kept thinking of Stepmom.
Right. Austin Butler. Yes, he's good. There's something about the way Austin Butler looks where he does resemble Elvis in certain ways. And I think in particular, they really nail it during the Elvis comeback years. So late 60s, I think in particular he does. But there's something about the way he looks where it's on and also extremely off, to compare it to another Tom Hanks movie, The Polar Express. There's something lifelike and Elvis-like about him. And then also, he's like a totally different person. He looks like... now we call this Adore Delano, but who used to be Danny Noriega on American Idol. That's who he kept looking like to me.
Yeah. I thought the performance was good, and I just do wish that we had more scenes with Austin Butler, because I feel like there's moments where he's really tapped into the role. Like, I think he's so, like, really into Elvis. And it makes sense, because the entire press tour was giving you Gaga and A Star Is Born.
Right.
And Gaga and House of Gucci, which is actually hilarious, because the end of the movie, I did not realize that Elvis was once being considered to be the Kris Kristofferson role in A Star Is Born.
And death took that opportunity away from him, but what really should have taken it away from him is that it's the world's longest fucking movie, and it is also terrible, and I blame Barbara.
Can you imagine if he had been in that?
I mean, he would have been a better actor than Kris Kristofferson, as my dad will tell you. That's my dad's one pop culture sticking point, is that Kris Kristofferson was such a bad actor. And we put him in tons of movies at the time.
But yeah, the movie truly just sort of ignores the character that you came to see. I think like it feels very Baz Luhrmann in that he has ADD and has to focus on everything else that's happening and all the music and all the spectacle and some interesting way to get into the story. But Tom Hanks in this fat suit as Colonel Parker was the most absurd thing I have seen on screen in quite some time. It is simultaneously worse and somehow more mesmerizing than Jared Leto in House of Gucci.
Yes. Well, I will say it's a little bit, it's not as extreme as Jared Leto in House of Gucci, but it is jarring.
Where does the accent come from?
No, you're telling me that's how Colonel Tom Parker
talks?
It
is not. It is not. I've watched video clips. That is not how Colonel Tom Parker talks.
It makes no sense. Also, just a weird role for Tom Hanks to take, ultimately. I don't feel like it taps into the best of his abilities. You know, I think of great Tom Hanks roles, and I think of empathy, or I guess just that. That's what he brings. And in this role, I needed like a slightly more menacing quality, I think. I think I needed to be a little bit more afraid of Tom Parker in this movie.
Mm-hmm. I feel like it's a bit like Road to Perdition, where he's playing against type, where he played like a mobster in that film, but it's so out of left field and it feels like it's like nothing really commits in it, because we also don't know anything about this man. I had to like Google after to find out like how he was born in the Netherlands and illegally immigrated to the US, but like never fully got his citizenship here, but renounced his Netherlands citizenship. So he sort of was like a man with no country.
I think also this movie just needed to have a little bit more to say about Elvis. I'm glad that we went through all the eras, because obviously we got musical performances and just all these songs that are really great. Obviously, Elvis's music is great. But I feel like the best version of this movie would have just focused on the comeback era, where, because then when you get, first of all, the best Elvis special, where he's on that square stage in the round and people are, you know, cheering for him as he brings back all these old hits and he's not a has-been anymore. You also get the crux of his relationship with Colonel Tom Parker, who's, you know, trying to force him into making a Christmas special, into performing these very safe songs. And Elvis is, you know, turning all these famous other hits on their head and creating a whole new generation of fans for himself. I think maybe if we had just focused on that, we would have gotten a more complete story. Because otherwise, what does this movie have to say about Elvis? It's saying he got popular. And by the way, it has nothing to say about how fast he got popular, other than he did know B.B. King and he did know Rosetta Tharpe. So there was some relationship with black artists that's important to him.
Let's get into that.
Yeah.
This movie, you would think
it was Midnight in Paris, the way he was mingling with these people. Yeah.
Which is actually not true with how he actually related to B.B. King. You know, like they would have met a couple times. I've read up about it, but they weren't just like hanging out at the local blues store doing, you know, like bebopping with each other. And yeah. I do want to say that an Elvis film should explore, obviously, what we now know about Elvis, with that he took, you know, like music and recordings like that black people had done, you know, and like was able to be successful and popular because he was white. I think that the film touches on that. And I think obviously, you know, like Elvis was supremely talented as well. But it doesn't really touch on that and like what it means in terms of just like the music industry. And it instead becomes this weird film where he's this like white kid who like stumbles into like a Baptist church, you know, and then like is like taken over by the music. It was sort of like the opening of Eyes of Tammy Faye. I'm tired of seeing this scene in films where like the young kid wanders into church and then all of a sudden is taken over by the Holy Spirit. And then it felt absurd where there are turning points in Elvis's life that are just like black like black things happening in the world are sort of like the impetus for him growing, particularly when he is sobbing to Martin Luther King being shot. And it is sort of like helping propel him into who he wants to be artistically. And then when RFK is shot, and it propels him again, even though RFK was actually shot during rehearsals. And so that actually did shake him a bit. But there just seemed to be so many moments, you know, where like it feels like MLK and like the civil rights movement and all this turmoil is, you know, like weighing on Elvis's soul and making him become the musician he's supposed to be.
Well, also, I would say this is a movie about Elvis periodically watching the news. That's what it is. You know, like, oh, I'm messing with the guitar here and turning to my left. Oh, MLK. He always said the right thing. Like, what? That's what you have to say about MLK. By the way, I don't know if he was talking to anybody in particular during that scene. I mean, it was hilarious, right?
And then the moment when Colonel Parker feels like one of those Republicans on Twitter who always likes to use one of the random older quotes of MLK that sort of aligns with what they have to say. When he leaves the room, he's like, you know, MLK said rock and roll was evil.
Right. People say lots of stuff. You can use whatever they say to justify whatever, wherever you're coming
from. I'm sure I said Fifi Dobson was evil at some point in 2002.
When she was a threat to take over, I remember. It was Pink versus Phoebe Dobson, and you know, the world went one way. Well, let's just talk about the music for a second, though. Do you have a favorite Elvis song they featured? At the end, they played In the Ghetto, which I think is one of Elvis's crowning achievements, and I'm glad that we got basically an entirely full performance of Suspicious Minds.
I love Suspicious Minds. Mm-hmm. Like the Suspicious Minds is just one of my favorite fucking songs, and I think it's beautiful. I'm shocked that we didn't hear much of Blue Suede Shoes. And is Blue Velvet an Elvis song, or is Blue Suede Shoes an Elvis song? And mostly, Blue Velvet was a Lana Del Rey cover it wasn't an originally Tony Bennett song.
Yeah, it went through several versions.
Yeah, I mean, whenever like Lana Del Rey wistfully sings something, I just always assume it used to be an Elvis song.
Also, Blue Suede Shoes, the rare case of Elvis lifting from a white artist, because that was a Carl Perkins song originally.
But I don't know. I mean, there's some others. I mean, I'm glad we didn't hear All Shook Up.
You're glad we didn't hear it.
I'm glad we didn't hear it, because I think, you know, I'm still haunted by that stage production.
Oh, of course. Is that also the one that maybe Celine Dion covered once upon a time?
Oh, she wore an Elvis suit while doing You Shook Me All Night Long.
Okay, well, then that's her fault. Dramaturgically, she messed up. As a historian, I'm disoriented now. Also, do you know what I kind of wish they'd gotten into more? And I just want to say it's an extremely long movie, so there had to have been time somehow. But Elvis's movie career, like after he comes back from Germany, after he comes back from being drafted, I needed to see Anne Margaret in this film a little bit. I needed to see, do you know who Carolyn Jones is? She played Morticia Adams in the original Adams Family. She did a movie with him called King Creole, which I think is probably the best Elvis performance and maybe movie. But I would have loved to see her haunted ass face in this movie. She's also an Oscar nominee, nominated for The Bachelor Party, one of the first Paddy Chayefsky written films. But honestly, if this movie were truncated, I think I would maybe even consider giving it a thumbs up, but
it's very long.
It's kitchen sinky. Yeah. And Wikipedia E. Yeah.
It's very long, and yet also doesn't include enough. I need the Priscilla film. How do you leave out the fact that Priscilla was having an affair with Elvis's karate instructor? How do you leave that out? And that he thought about hiring a hitman to kill the instructor. And that's why he knows karate, as he was doing, you know, in the special, and then like later does it when like someone runs up on stage after him. And also, I need the Priscilla film just to take place after Elvis's death for when she was on Dallas for 5 years.
That should just be a movie. Priscilla Presley on Dallas for 5 years. Let's just get into that miniseries. And also, again, there really should be in the maybe post-credit sequence in this movie, they should go through explaining how it is Riley Keough, Elvis's granddaughter, is such a good actress, because it simply doesn't make sense compared to what Elvis would bring on the silver screen, generally speaking.
One of the shocks, by the way, was seeing Dacre Montgomery from Stranger Things, who is so hot, playing Steve Binder, who was, you know, Elvis's like collaborator on the 68 special, but he also directed Diana Ross Live in Central Park.
Oh, wait, is that the one where it's raining on her?
Yes.
One of the unbelievable, heroic performances of our time. You got to YouTube that if you're unfamiliar.
I love when they used to play that like in gay bars all the time, but you know what? We've lost our history.
We need to support specifically these gay bars. And I'm thinking of one in Palm Springs. I'm pretty sure I brought it up recently. Quads. That just plays VHS tapes or converted VHS tapes to CDs of old television specials. You know, I'm talking about grainy Liza with the Z bars. That's what I want.
He also directed the Star Wars Holiday Special.
Legendaric. A word I rarely say.
Where's Steve Binder's biopic?
So, in short, the movie does have some good things going on, but it also has 7,000 other things going on. And one of them really isn't a meaty role for Austin.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I thought he ate, but I would have liked him to have a full meal, you know?
Yes. Yes. It was just a peanut butter and banana sandwich. You know, that's not going to fill you up.
It was past apps. Okay. Like Baz Luhrmann was handing out canapes. And there was a whole fucking like turkey in the back. Okay. There was mac and cheese. There were other side dishes, but Baz Luhrmann is never interested in that.
No. In fact, I can just fully say I just don't like his filmography. I brought up before how his greatest accomplishment is Elizabeth Debicki's performance in The Great Gatsby, but something about Moulin Rouge, even like Strictly Ballroom, after 20 minutes, how do you not get it already? Like he delivers on a vibe and delivers on a kind of frenetic, thrillingly random thing, and then he keeps doing that. Like, you can't keep being random. You have to like settle in something. You have to, I don't know, endear us a little bit, as opposed to just, you know, throttle us with spectacle, which is his only mode of artistry.
I feel like maybe he should do like short films or something, if only because even when he was doing television, like the pilot for The Get Down, which, you know, I loved parts of The Get Down, but like even that is like sort of all over the place, you know, and it's just, I have just come to the conclusion that like I don't think he's a great director. I think he does vibe. The music montages and elements are always fucking fantastic, but when he has to deliver drama, anything with like a dramatic weight or purpose, when there's no music playing, it's useless.
I also think our country is still in debt from what The Get Down cost. So I blame him for our current economic struggles. Gas prices are up because of Baz Luhrmann securing the rights to whatever funk classic he had at the beginning of The Get Down.
Favorite moments did include Elvis sitting on the Hollywood sign to clear his mind.
That was so out of like an Apple commercial starring Elvis.
And
also, by the way, I just want to be clear, Elvis takes a meeting at the Hollywood sign.
Yes.
Where he talks about it's when the comeback special is about to happen, and he's sitting there remarking on, oh, when I first came to Hollywood, I used to sit up here and think of being James Dean in Rebel Without a Cause, a name that comes up a couple of times in this movie. And then he asks whoever these people are to comment that his career is in the toilet. And then he says, I knew I liked you. And then they become collaborators.
Also, Elvis wants to fuck his mother in this film.
Yes, they have a very close relationship.
Their faces also, are always rubbing against one another in scenes. And I was like, what is going on here?
Yeah. Also, his childhood was just exactly Nightmare Alley, right? Up and down. It's a misty carnival with, you know, freaks in the background and a little bit of debauchery. It's like when Nightmare Alley came out, Baz had to be like, damn it, bitch, that was my thing.
I'm still giving it a thumbs up. I love that we've just shifted into at the movies now.
I'm totally down for it. Please. You ever just watch Siskel and Ebert? Oh my God. It's so watchable.
Can we backdoor keep it just into an at the movies reboot?
I think that's easy. I mean, who's doing that right now? Come on. I pick us.
But no thumbs up from you. Do you give it one of those old middle thumbs? The sideways thumb? Oh my God.
There's a Sesame Street episode, if I'm not mistaken, with Siskel and Ebert, where Ebert tries flying the half thumb or a thumbs halfway up. And it doesn't go over well with Gene, as you can imagine. Do I give it a halfway up? I would say thumbs down just because, I don't know, nothing was lasting about it ultimately. Like everything Baz Luhrmann does is just a glittery cookie you throw down the hatch.
I think it's something to experience. I don't know if it's an amazing film. It's not. But I would suggest that anyone see this in theaters. It feels like cinema to me, even though it is a mess.
Okay, so you're all over the place as usual, but going with thumbs up ultimately. You love mess, quote.
I do.
The Saint, Marie Kondo.
Yeah. When we're back, we're joined by the immaculate Jenny Slate. Keep It is brought to you by Barefoot Dreams. Lewis?
Yes?
When you see footprints in the sand, that was when I carried you in my Barefoot Dreams robe.
Now, is that a Leona Lewis song? No?
If you want to bring coziness into your life, you turn to Barefoot Dreams, especially now as the brand is celebrating their 30th anniversary. With those 30 years of coziness, Barefoot Dreams celebrates being the originators of everyone's favorite luxe home blanket. And while many have attempted to duplicate their blankets, robes, and more, Barefoot Dreams' fabrication and quality cannot be replicated, so don't believe the dupes. Girl, this blanket is it.
I effing love this blanket. I'm thinking about it right now, and I want to jump in my bed, which is sponsored by something that we'll do another ad for momentarily. Get ready. There's a reason why Barefoot Dreams has been on Oprah's favorite things list 6 times. Jesus. Get a life, Oprah. My God. Dressing head to toe in Barefoot Dreams is the key to comfort, as their collection of ultra-soft robes, loungewear, and accessories are made with premium materials. Their products make the perfect gifts, too. I throw this thing on. I wear it like a shawl. I look exactly like Ellen Burstyn. And I am the coziest a human being can be. Because, by the way, it's still that time in Los Angeles where it's like pretty mild outside and then your apartment is cold. I can't explain it. I don't know things like basic science. For Keep It listeners, you can get 15% off your first purchase at barefootdreams.com with the code KEEPIT15. Don't miss out on Barefoot Dreams' soft, soothing fabrics that will bring luxury to your life.
You've seen her in so many things. Parks and Rec, The Kroll Show, Obvious Child, and heard her iconic and very lovely and soothing voice in Bob's Burgers, Zootopia, Q-Force, and now she's returning to her breakout role as Marcel the Shell with Shoes On. Don't be suspicious. It's Jenny Slate. Welcome to Keep It.
Oh, hi. Thank you for having me. Don't be suspicious indeed. Don't be.
I truly, though, your voice is the most soothing thing I've ever heard. It's like I want more than Marcel. I want books on tape. I want like a more podcast things. I just want to listen to your voice at all times.
Geez, and I want all those compliments, so let's get into business together. It's so funny. I that's so nice to hear. And also, I when I was little, like, not because I liked how my voice sounded, but I just thought it was fascinating that you could like hear yourself and hear something new that you didn't think about when you were speaking and you thought you knew everything. I used to record myself all the time doing like really boring, what I thought would be shows for adults, but they would be like cooking radio shows, which maybe those exist now, but it would be like long instructions on how to cook something that I didn't know how to cook. So also it would be gross.
When you were a little kid, would people come up to you and just be like, you have an amazingly resonant voice, let's figure out something to do with it? Or is this a talent you developed on your own? Because as I'm sitting here listening to you, I'm just clutching the desk in front of me and enjoying it so much. So I'm sorry if that's creepy. It's true, though.
No, it's not. Nobody ever said that to me growing up. And in fact, I never, ever thought about being a voice actor or anything like that, or a radio person, I guess, you know, where you like you hear Terry Gross and her beautiful voice. And I never thought about it. I stumbled into my first voice work. I kind of still don't know how I got my first voice acting job, which was in the movie The Lorax. I mean, I honestly, this is such a pessimistic thing to say or cynical, but I guess I must have been part of a package. I actually really don't know. I'm like, why am I in this movie at that time in my career? I mean, now I think, yes, I've done a lot of work and I've proved myself. But at the time, it was like The Lorax, starring like Danny DeVito and Taylor Swift and Zac Efron and Betty White. And they were like, and Jenny. The so it was odd. But I obviously didn't bat an eye. I had had a general with a preliminary meeting. For those who aren't in the industry, a general meeting, aka a date with a stranger from your industry where you talk about professional things. I'm the only one in the world who likes general meetings, but I love them. And I talked with this really nice lady, and then I ended up getting a part. So maybe it was from that. Maybe.
I used to like them when, pre-pandemic general mm-hmm. meetings, I'll set the stage for people listening, where you would, you know, hop in the car and yeah. go, like, I don't know where you live, but like I lived at like West Hollywood. There was a period where I was living at like Virgil Village, but it's like every place mm-hmm. that you are assigned to have a meeting ends up being in Santa Monica or Burbank.
Yeah, Studio City, right?
Yeah, so it's just I enjoyed, you know, the journey of being in the car alone, and then you get there and you do meet a stranger, and it truly is like dating a stranger in your industry in the sense that. You have that first date, you'd never see or hear from this person again, even though they're like, we got to work together, we got to do something together. And then 6 years later, you'll be like working on something and that person will be like, oh, hey, I remember you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I find it's a real, first of all, I know exactly what you're talking about. I love the long drive because also in that time, especially if you're meeting someone who's like, whatever, like important in one, like they run a company that they make a lot of movies there or something. It's really important in the car ride to like listen to the songs that remind you of yourself, you know, in the coolest way and make you feel really good. And I like to sing really loud, get some energy out. And I've always found it to be pretty fun. And then I actually think they are fruitful, but it's just an exercise in patience. It really is. Like somebody I had a general meeting with like 5 years ago. Now I'm doing like a couple projects with them, but almost everything now that I enjoy in my career took a long time. Like I made my comedy special after doing about like 15 years of stand-up, and I made the Marcel movie after 12 years of co-creating that character. And you know, like everything kind of seems to take me a long time, including getting jobs from a general.
Now, here's my problem with generals. I found I would always enjoy like the quote unquote interview and the conversation and the date like atmosphere of it. But then inevitably you get to the part of the conversation where they're like, so what are you into right now? And I would say like the TV I liked, and maybe it's just I was meeting with too many men, but I would say I loved a show like Lady Dynamite with Maria Bamford. And it was like I had said, oh, I love the works of Leni Riefenstahl. Like people, like if you didn't say the number one most popular show, you were completely freaking them out.
Yeah, yeah. You kind of like that is true. But I also there is no point in being there, at least for me, if I'm to show something that doesn't really exist, you know, like I would much rather go in there and be like, oh, by the way, I also love Lady Dynamite. I play the therapist on that show who has sex with her brother.
yes.
Or I don't know if they go all the way, but they're definitely into each other and they're definitely doing some stuff. But played by Jason Mantzoukas, who's incredible. But I think it's better to say what your true references are as a creative person, because if not, then they end up calling you for something if they do something that you really don't want to do, and then you have to insult them. And at least for me, I have lived with the guilt that like I misrepresented myself or what I was interested in just to be included, and like, ooh, what a fool's errand that is. <You know? laughs> That'll slam you down in the end. It really sucks.
I want to talk about, you know, the process in getting Marcel from, you know, the short like 12 years ago to like a feature length film now. First of all, it's beautiful. I told a friend I was seeing it, my friend Juan, and he was like, I laughed, I cried, it was so emotional. And then I did all of those things. So it's really a lovely film. But like, where has your mind been with, I create this character years ago, and then I'm going to decide to make a film out of it, but also the process is going to take so long?
I think it's a little bit of what I was just saying, but then also really boosted by Dean Fleischer Camp, who I co-created this character with, and he directed the film, and we co-wrote it with Nick Paley. I think he is like a very, very good example of a true artist, and it works really well because we have really different personalities. Like Dean he's really, in terms of what he wants to do and what work he thinks is quality, he's really uncompromising, and that helped me to, in my own way, adopt that belief system and figure out how to stay there. But I think it comes from being satisfied at first. Like, we really liked the character. We really liked how he was, and we liked his world. And so when we were presented with really just conversations from studios and stuff, like, how do you, maybe we'll make this into a movie. And I don't remember those pathways really feeling like they worked for us. And it wasn't a discussion at the time, but I think one thing that we knew is either we won't make a movie, and we would have to be fine with that, and just keep making shorts and try to be happy that way, or we will, and it just won't be a traditional process. You can't ask for everything. And I think the process also was long because we were moving through like really, really real feelings that we were both trying to understand as different people. And it just, everyone's like, oh my gosh, you know, the movie took 7 years to make. And it's not like every day you're on like day 30 and you're looking forward to year 7 and being like, how are we going to do this? Like looking up from the bottom of a mountain. It's more like a general, like, I'd like to travel the world. Hopefully I will. And you go like place by, like moment by moment by moment. It's not, it didn't feel, at least to me, like my patience was running out or that I was strenuous. And also there's like lots of different artists involved in the film itself.
Speaking of non-traditional choices and a non-traditional journey, I have to bring up two words that I feel are very important in regards to this film, and they are Isabella Rossellini.
Yeah.
There are very few celebrities nowadays who, it's not that she's intimidating. Actually, it's the opposite. It's that she has a regality, but also seems rad. Like, she comes from the Ingrid Bergman universe, but she also seems to want to hang, and like, you know, her Instagram is full of life. She's, you know, just a cool, unusual celebrity. And I thought, was wondering, how did she get involved with this?
Isabella is that kind of like living bridge from before to now. And not just because like she's here, but she also remembers, you know, Hollywood in her own mother, Ingrid Bergman's time. But that also she like just learns and learns and learns and learns all the time. She's always reaching for what interests her. And, you know, we thought it was a very, very huge wish that she would be in the movie, but I don't think we really thought we would get her at all. And then I think her agents brought her the treatment. We didn't we didn't start with a script, although there ended up being a script after improvising and writing and improvising and writing and editing and improvising and writing, whatever. Isabella just saw the treatment, like the long form paragraph document of what we thought the movie would be about. And she said that she had no idea who Marcel Michel was at all. So she was not a fan. And her kids were. And her children told her, you should really do this. And that astounds me that as Isabella Rossellini, she came to our, you know, like where we were recording, which was like a house that we rented in Silver Lake, where Dean and I both lived. And like we lived in that neighborhood and rented a house there. And that's where we recorded. And she just showed up there and like ordered Postmates with us. Like that is the story. She was just willing to really do it how we were doing it. And that is incredible. We never even thought that far ahead. You know, when we thought, let's ask Isabella, we weren't like, oh, right. And then she'll like show up here where we're in like weird outfits and have microphones taped to our foreheads. And she'll do that with us and let our like dogs sit on her. Crazy.
I love the fact too that like the recording got to be, you know, more organic with her being there, because yeah, I know we both done voice acting before, you know, and it's, yeah. I hate sort of like the fact that, you know, like sometimes you'll just be not in the room with the people that you're working with, you know?
Right.
And I want to say that Isabella Rossellini did, I'm not shocked that she did this, because she did, I don't know if you know my friend Stephen Dunn, who created the new Queer as Folk, but she did his movie, Closet Monster, where she played a hamster named Buffy. And that is truly one of the moments where I was like, I love this woman. From that and her 30 Rock character. And
the Big Beef and Cheddar.
The Big Beef and Cheddar line. The Big Beef and Cheddar line is in my head every day.
Yeah,
and it's never going to leave it.
Nor should it. Yeah, I think she thrives on the experimental. And she was like really genuinely fascinated by how we were trying to do this movie. And
well, she was married to David Lynch, so you must thrive on the experimental.
Yeah, you got to be into that. And she was into that. And you know, like, and we were really dedicated to having like natural sound. We never recorded in a studio at all. And when we were in Nana Connie, her character's garden, we were actually at her farm, which was like so nice of her. She made us lunch and showed us all of her animals. It was crazy.
What is lunch from Isabella Rossellini? Like, does she make you ham sandwiches? Does she make you Tostino's pizza rolls?
You know that it was a beautiful feast. It was a beautiful feast, you know, like lovely salads and grain-based dishes and a roasted chicken. And she was at the head of the table and we were just in her house. And it's like beautiful old, to me, it almost seemed like a converted, like it was a farmhouse, but also just like there was so much old planks and stuff, you know?
Now, do you have a favorite VO experience outside of the Marcel universe? Because you're so experienced with it now. And I imagine a lot of the time it's very tedious or you're having to get 700 takes of a single line. So I was wondering if it ever was just pleasurable and ideal.
You know, it actually almost always is. I really like it. It's such a weird job to have. I mean, obviously, I love in the past at like Bob's Burgers when we would all be together. And, you know, like we would just go on crazy runs that they would never put in the show. Just like me and Kristen Schaal doing whatever we wanted to do, you know. Like that I love is the ensemble thing and just the shows that are so, so funny. I mean, every time I record Bob's Burgers or The Great North, I feel like I just ruin so many takes by laughing so hard. And that I enjoy. And there are just so many, it seems like a limiting performance experience or something, but it really isn't, because actually you're just like putting everything into one tiny beam. I don't know if you feel this way, but like that's how I feel about it. And during the pandemic, I live in Massachusetts most of the time, and I was newly pregnant and I hadn't told anyone about that. And it sort of felt like double isolation in a way. And so to be able to go into my little linen closet here and just still do my acting basically was a major lifeline for me. Yeah. Yeah. I love it.
It's a really fun and like, weird muscle to work out, because I you know, mm-hmm. like you said, like listening to your voice and discovering new things. I think Lewis and I have both gone through the process of, I used to hate listening to anything that involved me. And then there's uh-huh. also the point when you have to get used to what you hear in your head is completely yeah. different from what other people hear. And like, this voice doesn't exist. It's because it's rattling sometime in your skull or something. How do you practice or flex the muscle of coming up with different voices, coming up with different ways for your voice to sound? And like, do you record it and then like listen to how it sounds? Or do you just go with, I feel like it sounds different?
There's so much that gets lost. Like... And with my stand-up, too, like, there's just so much that gets lost. I did start recording my stand-up a few years ago, like 4 years ago, because I was like, someone would be like, remember that thing you said? And I would just be like, no, I don't. And now I'll never know what it was. And it's so annoying because this is actually my job. But then, you know what I mean? But then the second part of that is that, yeah, this is my job. But the only reason why I have it is because it's like an extension of how I'm like, playful as a person. And so that's how it always starts, is like seeing a weird object or finding my body in a weird posture or finding myself in a really weird situation and then finding a voice to match that. It's weird that also I wouldn't just use my own voice, but that's not my inclination a lot of the times. And I feel like Marcel's the only voice I've ever created that I'm like, I don't really know another voice like that. Like, I'm not mimicking anything else. Everything else I'm sort of like mimicking an accent, or I'm pretty bad at like real accents. Like, I can't do a real British accent, but I can do like Mrs. Doubtfire is like, hello. Like, I have nothing at all. But I do think at first it just comes from having fun, which is such a silly answer, but it really, really is true that like, all of my best things, when I say my best things, the things I like the most, come from either actively having fun or trying to figure out why something isn't fun and where the blockage or the injury is. And that is like, that's how I know how to do it now. But I don't record the voices when I do them. And I think it's just too embarrassing. Like, if I come up with a new voice, I'm just not going to grab my voice memo and make a voice memo. Although I will say there's a song in Marcel the Shell that he sings towards the end. If people haven't heard it, I sort of don't want to spoil the surprise because it is deeply random. But it's a song that I recorded at like 2 a.m. when I was singing covers to myself as Marcel. And we were about a year into recording the movie, and I sent the voice memo to Dean and asked, like, is there any way we could use this? Because I actually think it sounds really good. I don't know, though.
Also, that's very fascinating that you sometimes just sing covers as Marcel. Do you have particular favorites that you would go to?
Oh my gosh, I have a lot. I love Marcel because I think his singing voice is like better than mine, you know, like I really do think. And like, I love to sing Dionne Warwick.
Oh,
I love,
yes.
Loretta
Marcel
Lynn.
And I have Marcel and I have that in common. All
Who
right.
doesn't? When I was a little girl and I would be like, we had water skiing at camp. I have no idea why I ever even tried it. I hate taking physical risks, but for some reason I did it. And I would be behind the boat and the only thing that would calm me down is singing. Like, keep shining, keep smiling, keep smiling, keep shining. What goes first? No, and you can always count on me. That's what friends are for. That's what I would sing behind the boat. And Marcel sings that. And I think it's really good.
It makes me wish we got Gladys Knight and Elton in this movie, too. But that's all right.
No, my dream is like an album of covers with Marcel, but in a duet with the original artist. I think that would be like so cool. Yeah.
I would listen to them. That sounds really sweet.
Keep Shining should be the name of the album. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Keep Shining. Marcel and Ben.
I want to ask you a bit too about you know, your stand up, because you know you've had this project for so long, and now is stand up still like a thing that you enjoy as much as, you know, like, I think a lot of people remember you had Big Terrific, you know, with Max Silvestri and Gabe Leadbit, and then you did your own stand up, but like, is that a thing that you still enjoy as much? Have you been like excited to get back to it now that people are back in public spaces again? Or have you just been so focused on making this project?
Oh, no, I'm definitely excited to get back to it. I do think the pandemic was a great break for me. I am kind of that person that, like, even if I have a dinner plan with my favorite person and they're like, I have to cancel, I'm like, oh, great, I'll just stay home and do nothing. Like, I love a cancellation. it has nothing to do ever with the person. It's just, I actually just think it's from that weird trembling, like, shyness like, laziness combination that I have. But I really missed stand-up. And not having the pandemic, you know, not having a stand-up to do during the pandemic also means there's a backlog of experience that I haven't, like, funneled through the mic. And I also feel like, I don't know, I like to try to get real. But now the stuff that I'll be talking about in, I mean, I'd like to make another stand-up special, if they'll let me, if someone will let me. And I think that what will be cool about it is that it will tell a story backwards, like from now. You know, there's no way for me to go into a room or get up on a stage and not say, like, oh, yeah, I had a baby during the pandemic. I, like, exploded my vagina with a mask on. And that is something that is, like, I remember about myself, and I kind of have to, like, call it out. Like, it's a positive thing. It used to be that after I moved to L.A., after getting fired from SNL, that I would go into any meeting and be like, I know, I got fired. And everyone would be like, we don't care. Nobody cares about you. Nobody cares. But it's the opposite with having a baby, that they're like, actually, people do care. And it's a nice thing. And it's the best thing in general that has happened to me in my life. So I think the special would go from, like, having a baby, but then to kind of talk about, like, how I got there, because my last special ended with me, like, literally saying, I'm so disappointed in all men that now I just, like, masturbate to the moon because there's, like, nothing left. and it's like, wait, hold on. Then how did you get here? And I'm excited to do it, but I also think I'm scared because a lot of it will be having to fashion things that are ugly to me or embarrassing or shameful into, like, a bit of beauty and fun. And I think that's, like, why I do stand up, to repurpose the things that I really say don't belong and that I think they feel bad about me, and not make fun of myself, but truly just, like, repurpose them, like, just find a way to make them into something new. And if people can laugh at them while they also love you rather than laughing at you in ridicule, I think you, like, give it a new place to live, you know?
Is there a particular emotional experience in that universe right now you're having trouble converting into comedy?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really hard to talk about feeling like you're not enough, like, a feeling that comes from you, that, like when I met my husband, I was, like, so pumped about him, and also so, I'm trying to find other words than, like, insecure or jealous, because they weren't about the other people. They were about me. I felt, like, really frightened about the world of social media. Like, it really weirded out that at this point you can meet a total stranger and they have this weird online connection or portal that's supposed to be innocuous to, like, everyone they've ever maybe, like, slept with or known, and that they get to, like, still see pictures of that person, like, in their bikini on their, like, vacation to Thailand, and, like, how weird that is, like how weird it is, but maybe it's only weird to me and there's something wrong with me. And you know, so, like, starting to make jokes about, like, how painful it is to not be able to accept the way our world functions, and, like, how do you build your own self-confidence when there's also a part of you that's, like, you're so weak, you're so insecure, just whatever. And, like, I'm reluctant to say any of the things that I'm toying around with, because I'm still, like, maybe it's bad and I'm easily discouraged. So usually, like, the way I make a joke is to say it for the very first time on stage, the way that it comes to me, because usually that's, like, how I want to please people. So I don't know, like, so far I've been right on. But maybe this is when I start to truly eat shit. I don't know. I watched all of Hacks. I, like, ate every episode up, like, cried through every episode. Love it so much. Relate deeply to Gene Smart's character, even though I'm 40. I'm not, like, I'm not like that far along, but yeah, I just think the things, like, I want to talk about the things that I know that in my life I've settled now and I'm happy. I feel safe and good. And I just want to talk about what it used to be like when it was bad, because I don't know, from everything I've learned, it's so cool to get past a fear, but you're kind of a fool if you think it's not going to come back and tap you on the shoulder again somewhere down the line.
Okay. Ominous, yet true.
Yeah, I think so, though. I think so. Sorry.
Ooh, yeah. Light Crypt Keeper vibes.
Yeah. I know, but just... I always have them a little bit. Like, I'm just always at my worst when I'm like, oh, man, I thought I was over this. And then it comes back.
I'm just imagining like a hand from like a creepy like Goosebumps cover. I don't know, like,
yeah, Goosebumps,
just,
right?
Just reaching out and touching you.
Hello, yeah. Sorry.
I lastly just want to say that I am excited that you are included in the pantheon of people who've played Harley Quinn, one of my favorite characters.
All right.
So Gaga, Margot Robbie, and you.
I know, just a touch of me, though. Just about seven lines. But I mean, I'll take it.
That might be all the lines that Gaga has in Joker 2, for all we know.
Yeah, right.
Since it's a musical, so who knows?
It is. I don't know anything about what's going on. She's going to be in that movie? I'll see it.
I'll see it. She's in heavy talks, as they say, to be Harley Quinn opposite Joaquin Phoenix in a musical sequel to Joker.
Wow. Look what they did.
It feels like something that happened at a drunk general, does
oh
it not?
My God.
What if we turned it into a musical? You know?
It's really, I mean, and maybe it will be so wonderful. I mean, I'll go and see it. But I didn't know that. And also I've never heard, I mean, maybe I've heard it and I just didn't keep it in my mind, but the phrase heavy talks is like, wow, that's so titillating. I would love to be in some heavy talks.
Heavy talks sounds like a 80s film starring, I don't know, like Rob Lowe and
Steven Seagal. Yeah, heavy talks.
Yeah, heavy talks. Well, thank you so much for being here, Jenny. And congrats on the film. It is truly exceptional. And congrats on the long journey to getting it made into a feature film, finally.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Thank you so much.
Do you find yourself searching for true crime podcasts that are different from what you're always recommended? Do you want to make a real difference in the cases that you're following? Well, you're a crime junkie, and I'm Ashley Flowers, the creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. There are hundreds of episodes already available, and each Monday we dive into the details of cases spanning from some of the most infamous to those that you have never heard covered before. Listen to Crime Junkie podcast now, wherever you're listening.
And we're back with our favorite segment of the episode, Keep It. Lewis, what is your Keep It?
I just want to say there's a lot less suspense when it's just the two of us. When we're like passing the hat and we're, you know, there were three and it was a bunch of Keep Its, it really felt conspiratorial. Now it just seems like two gay guys bitching, which is fine.
It works for Las Culturistas.
Does it? My Keep It this week. I don't know why it's fun to clown on them. They're like my friends. I don't know. My Keep It this week is to all of the promotional stills or just candid stills we're getting of the Barbie movie. Not that I don't like looking at them. So far, we've gotten Ryan Gosling in Malibu Ken gear, bright blonde hair, denim vest, plasticine abs, looking cute, looking like somebody's twink husband who gets the Maltese in the divorce. But here's the problem. We're already getting all the candy-colored looks from this movie. This movie does not come out for another fucking year. I have the weird feeling we are going to OD on the promo materials for this, what I'm assuming is going to be a great movie because Greta Gerwig is in charge of it. A couple of people have noted this on Twitter. It feels like we're going to get a version of the Brady Bunch movie where the Kens and Barbies are in their own doll universe and everybody else looks at them with contempt and confusion. And I hope that's the case, because that's obviously a really fun vibe. But man, we are still so far out from this that I just hope it's still novel by the time it comes out. My God, 2023? Words I don't even like to say out loud, let alone realize that's when we're getting the fucking Barbie movie.
I'm trying to remember what other recent film had it where it was just like we just constantly kept getting stills for it.
And well, you know what one version was is Joker, which we got stills for fucking ever.
We kept seeing him, just like dancing on stairs, being like, "What the fuck is happening in this film?" And then we saw the film, man. At least we know Barbie will not be like a Todd Phillips film.
Oh my God. No, your lips to God's ears. That's a keep it up. Keep it up to not resembling Joker in any shape or form.
Speaking of keep it up, there was a movie announced today, a new Pedro Almodovar film.
What? Our fave.
And it is another short film. I love him in his era of making short films now.
Yeah, he did this one recently with Tilda Swinton called The Human Voice, which is just, I'm going to call it a demented take on The Sims.
This is going to be a 30-minute Western called The Strange Way of Life, which is described as his answer to Brokeback Mountain.
What? Oh, my God. First of all, that seems saucy and a little underhanded, which I love.
The Manu Rios is co-starring in it.
Great.
Alongside two of the only men I will allow to play gay, Pedro Pascal and Ethan Hawke.
Oh, they're on the list. All right, I'm gonna form my own after a certain point. Straight men I want to see play gay who are capable of it. I guess Andrew Garfield already did it because he did it on Broadway. Has he done it on the silver screen yet?
Well, he's done it in our apartment.
Okay, I don't know what that means. Nor will I ask.
All right, that's all of your keep it just to the Barbie stills.
I just am worried we're going to get burnt out on this Crayola Wonderland, and I would prefer, you know, I think all movies should be this color, let alone just one that's about Barbie. So I hope we still love it a year from now.
You know what I will say as a known faggot who grew up in the era we did? Never had a Barbie fascination.
Me neither. Nor did I have even kind of like a gay curiosity about like those types of doll. I know that's like half of gay men's childhoods. But I don't know. And I can't really explain it because I would play with like quote unquote action figures and stuff. Like I had all toys of like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Street Fighter and stuff like that. And I was obsessed with the Chun-Li doll. Mm-hmm. So there was like a girl doll element to my childhood, but Barbie never did it for me. I guess I didn't really understand what Barbie was up to. Like just getting into a car sometimes. I did that already.
And she had her one black friend and then her cousin Skipper. There seemed like a lot of like high school dynamics going on, and I already had enough to figure out. Like I remember the Barbie cartoons and things too, like never even watched them.
No. There came like the Barbie computer games and stuff. Yeah. Maybe I had three brothers. Maybe I never even allowed myself to consider that Barbie could be a part of my playtime universe because I was too busy with whatever the fuck they had bought, Lego, everything.
Yeah. I feel like I know more about the extended Malibu Stacy universe than I do Barbie.
Yeah. What's going on there?
Maybe The Simpsons ruined Barbie for us, actually.
Mm,
but you didn't watch The Simpsons as a kid, so that's not even correct for you.
No. My mom made me afraid of The Simpsons. She had heard it was, whatever, satanic. My mom became a rad person eventually, but she was, for like 10 seconds, Piper Laurie and Carrie.
That explains so
much
about
you. By the way,
is
still with us. The great Piper Laurie, still here. Yes. She spoke at something a couple weeks ago, and I was like in tears hearing that she was just out and about and being cool. Anyway, Ira, what is your keep it this week?
Piper Laurie's still alive. Find her on Keep It in 6 weeks.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
I'm sure there's an older actress like AOL message board that they still chat on where they're like, have you heard of this podcast? Keep it. Because they're all just coming on it.
Right. No, Mary Kay Place is like, fuck, it's going to be me next.
My keep it goes to the BET Awards.
Oh, what? I didn't see them this year, and I do watch them every year. Routinely, I think they have the best performances.
They do usually have the best performances. I'm still just mad about the entire Lil Nas X situation.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it's not, and I do want to point out that we at least got out of it his new song, Life of the Party, which is fantastic and starts with him chanting fuck BET, which I find is hilarious. I like when musicians or artists just sort of like start hating on like a network.
Oh,
or
yeah.
Like
no,
a conglomerate.
That's very Neil Young, This Note's For You, with his snarling MTV put-downs.
And I feel like it reminds me of like when Kanye West had like fuck SNL and the whole cast in his song, but then changed it once he got on SNL. I feel like Lil Nas X would not change his tune. And I actually don't know how this ever becomes reconciled, because it's still this idea that, you know, the black network, which should be supporting him, isn't supporting him, you know? And it's the same way, you know, like we weren't getting awards for Pose, you know? It's because it's like, it's gay shit. So it's like, it's not being supported in the way that it should be. And he had a lot of stuff to say in the press, too, about how it wasn't just the not being nominated. It was, you know, them last year during his performance, you know, like sort of like making him swear that he wasn't worshiping Satan, and then saying that like his performance was like the most awful thing they'd ever seen after he like kissed a man on stage, like once he got off stage. So it's been like a year of awfulness. And then just to also like have a tribute in their in memoriam to this, you know, internet star Kevin Samuels, who mostly had like a lot of videos with titles like Women Should Let Men Use Them and How Much Does Your Submission Cost and Modern Women Are Average at Best. That felt like a slap in the face. Just mostly because this is what BET does. And it reminds me of the BET I grew up with. And I thought that we had sort of moved past that.
Yeah, that feels very, very old. I mean, it just sounds like, I don't know. Tipper Gore is the name that's coming to mind. She's not the exact parallel, but like somebody from the 80s condemning you for listening to whatever gay thing was happening at the time, Boy George or something.
I would condemn people for listening to Boy George, Lewis.
Oh, come on. I'll tumble for you. That's the song.
You know, Boy George used to have me blocked on Twitter.
Really? Does that mean he's on Twitter now?
I think so. Boy George, well, because Boy George was in Real Housewives of Beverly Hills for a long spell because he was the close friend of housewife Dorit Kemsley and her husband, PK, whose full name is Paul Kemsley, was Culture Club's manager. And Boy George lived in their guest house.
Okay, that is information you would think I'd have known. Because my day's different now. Did he look like he did during the Taboo era with Rosie O'Donnell, where he had like the black drips coming down his head?
Not that horrific.
Okay, because that really was a shock for the ages.
Yeah, so like I didn't like him on the show at the time, so I tweeted about it, and then I was blocked.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, you brought it on yourself. Now I understand. Well, now yeah. I'm going to be listening to Boy George the rest of the day and think about how he hates your guts.
Sounds like a good day for you.
Yeah.
I'm inching closer to making you watch a single episode of Real Housewives of Beverly Hills.
Get this. Last weekend, I was in San Francisco, and my friend Alex, who I always go up to see, is obsessed with the entire Housewives universe. So I did see a full episode of whatever this new vacation thing is with Dorinda.
Real Housewives Ultimate Girls Trip 2, Ex-Wives Club.
Yes. Okay, is it really an ultimate girls trip if they're just fucking sitting around? Is it? Don't lie to me, Andy Cohen.
The last one was a trip to Turks and Caicos. And this one now is like Bluestone Manor, which Dorinda owns. It's in Massachusetts and the Berkshires. And these are ex housewives who are now like all gathered. Oh my God, I need your thoughts on Dorinda.
Dorinda, I was wondering why she would have been kicked off the show. I don't know any of the lore of Housewives.
She drinks too much and gets messy, and it's just sort of like she was sort of removed from the show for her own good, to be honest.
No, her drinking was Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf level. I mean, I you could see it from the last seats in the theater. No, but it was weird to see, like, Jill Zarin. I watched the first season of New York, so that's, mm-hmm. like, a name that kind of looms large to me. And not bringing anything. Vicky, I can't believe we had her on TV that long. Not bringing anything.
Did you see her talking about vaccines?
Vicky or Jill?
Vicky.
Oh, no. I mean, I don't really need to see her opine on anything, to be honest. So I liked the religious woman on this season.
Phaedra Parks.
Things to say. Yeah. Oh, yes. Phaedra. Funny.
She is very sweet. If you forget the fact that the reason she was fired from Real Housewives of Atlanta is because she did make up a rumor that Candy Burris tried to drug and rape someone in her dungeon.
I mean, I'm simply speechless. The writer of No Scrubs going ahead and being just a full criminal and, I guess, murderer.
Yeah. So that came out at a Real Housewives reunion, that Phaedra was the one who made up that rumor. So she's been gone from the show ever since then. And then were you happy to see Ava Marcel?
Yes, though I hadn't missed her.
I will say that as someone who watched her on Housewives of Atlanta, she was always pregnant, and so she was boring, but she just gets stoned on this trip, and so I find her very pleasant and enjoyable.
Yeah, I mean, like, it feels like a very COVID-era show. They're, like, playing ring toss indoors to pass the time.
Yeah. All right, well, I'm glad that Alex Merriman was good for one thing, and that's making you watch Real Housewives.
If he has one legacy in this life, here it is. He's also going to be a heart surgeon, but arguably this is his more towering achievement.
I wouldn't let him operate on me.
Well, it's not really up to you if you're in his hands after a while.
He's giving me Izzy, okay? I mean he's cutting LVAX. All right, that's our show this week.
Thanks to the great Jenny Slate for being here. God, what a pleasure.
Yeah. And we will see you not next week because we're off again.
I have to say, I feel bad that we did this, but guys, I'm going to be in Fire Island. You don't want me reporting from the trenches in whatever state I'm in.
So we'll see you again in 2 weeks. Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our senior producer is Kendra James. Our producer is Chris Lord. Our executive producers are Ira Madison III
and Louis Fortel.
Our editor is Charlotte Landis, and Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer.
Thank you to our digital team, Matt DeGroot, Nara Malkonian, and Delon Villanueva for production support every week.
Do you find yourself searching for true crime podcasts that are different from what you're always recommended? Do you want to make a real difference in the cases that you're following? Well, you're a crime junkie. And I'm Ashley Flowers, the creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. There are hundreds of episodes already available, and each Monday we dive into the details of cases spanning from some of the most infamous to those that you have never heard covered before. Listen to Crime Junkie podcast now, wherever you're listening.